Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We have a really amazing guest for you guys today. His name is Joe Weisenthal. He's a senior editor and host of a TV show over at Bloomberg News. Joe is probably the single most insightful person I know whenever it comes to finance, economics. This guy can tell you everything from technical, like little charts about inflation rates and all that other stuff, and then distill it down for somebody like me to understand, and more importantly, for somebody like you guys to understand. I really can't wait to share this conversation with all of you, especially in the middle of these horrific stimulus negotiations which are happening right now on Capitol Hill. I can't tell you what's going to happen, you know, whenever this comes out. It comes out a day after that we're talking about it here, Marshall. But where things stand right now, Nancy Pelosi has no interest in doing a deal. Senate Republicans don't either. And a lot of people are going to basically go hungry, starve, and not have any money until January 2021 at the very earliest, which I think is probably the greatest policy failure in a long time.
And that's the key takeaway from the episode, is that this is not necessary. The consistent thing that Joe hits is these are policy choices that we are making. It's a policy choice to not pass a stimulus. It's a policy choice to enable these situations to sort of continue. And this episode was really cathartic for, I think, the both of us, because part of the reason why, though, we're seeing the stimulus package debate sort of stall is I don't think people quite understand what's happening right now. You have to sort of understand so many different facets of so many different debates. So, for example, and this is why Joe's so great on this episode, Joe's capable of going from, why is Disney's streaming conversion when all the movie theaters are shut down? Why is that situation different than Blockbuster getting supplanted by Netflix in 2011? Why is it that the debate over, well, if we spend money, we're going to give burdens to our grandchildren, how does that interplay with the fact that if your grandchildren are growing up in a future where you, the grandparent, were out of work for years, couldn't pursue an education? He talks about the fact that people who graduate from college during periods of economic devastation, how there's a long-term impact on their wages. It seems like those things are pretty bad for grandchildren too. So he's just able to hit all these sort of different points in a way that's really, really appreciated. But he's also just not partisan either. He's just very clearly as an analyst. There's this funny thing where he talks about how he was just a blogger. That's how he got started. So you just see this, you really see him as a guy in 2005 who's just writing all this on his blog. So it's really great.
Okay, so before we guys give you our discussion, which again, we just love so much. Just a reminder, if you write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, you can ask us a question within that review and we will answer it here right on the air. And if you don't want to do that, no worries. Take a screenshot of your 5-star review. Just send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com also with your question. So here we are. Marshall, what's the question we got?
This question is startlingly on the nose because we host a podcast and Joe hosts a podcast as well, too. It's called Odd Lots. It's really great. Definitely subscribe to it. This question from Laura is, what advice would you give a newbie podcaster / YouTuber?
Ooh, this is an interesting question. I mean, I think it's a fun one, considering we basically built two properties from scratch, both Rising and this one. The most important thing that I always tell people, what makes you different than everybody else? If you are a comedy podcaster, good luck, man. You know, it's a crowded space out there. I hope that you're famous, or I hope you have some famous friends who can elevate you, because that's pretty much the only way that it's going to happen. Whenever it comes to politics, there was obviously a specific niche for Rising, which resonated. I think that's the same thing here. I don't know anybody else who's doing anything even close to what you and I are doing here, Marshall. So there's a couple of things there, too. It's not just about identifying a market need. It's also about having the requisite credentials, connections, and other things to book good guests and provide value to your audience. I know a lot of it can seem like we are just having fun whenever I'm on Rising or here, and we definitely are. But Marshall and I and Crystal and I mean, we put hours of effort and work into thinking, how is this gonna enrich the knowledge of my audience? I think about that all the time. I think about you guys way before I think about anything that I'm personally interested in. And, you know, we'll cover that and talk about it from time to time. But chief determiner is you guys every single time. I think you have to adopt that mindset if this is a space that you want to go into.
Yeah, so the key thing, and I'm glad that Laura asked about podcasting slash YouTube, you have to understand those are two different formats, right? And you know this, Sagar. YouTube mm-hmm. is something where there's an algorithm that could recommend you. So if you, for example, wanted to do us a favor and do a realignment commentary YouTube page where you sort of talked about the themes of every episode, you would actually probably get preferenced in the algorithm if you put Marshall Kozloff and Sagar and Jetty in the name. That can help people find it. With podcasting, there's nothing like that. With podcasting, you're literally competing with millions and millions and millions of other podcasts, and there's no clear way for people to really discover you other than, frankly, Twitter, which becomes another big issue when it comes to not really, if you don't really have that big of a following, so it's harder and harder to get discovered there. So the thing that's important when you're thinking about that is that am I creating a format that like makes sense for what I'm trying to do? If you're just trying to talk into a microphone, that sounds like great for podcasting. Also, if you're not really trying to make money, that makes sense with podcasting too. So you have to think deeply about that. But just to build on Sagar's point about identifying niches and audiences, I think that something you should do is think really hard about like what's a group of people who I'm sort of aware of or in cahoots with that I could serve. So if, for example, you are a senior in college right now who's thinking about going into the job market and you're really trepidatious, what if you made a podcast or a YouTube channel that was all about talking with people in industries you're interested about going into the job market or thinking about politics? Like, this is the 1 year of all of our lives when basically everyone is either sitting at home most of the time. So real talk, like there's a reason why, like when you guys email us, 99% of the time we respond, we'll take phone calls and engage because you have the real time to do it. So thinking about those leverage points, that's really huge. So as always, really great question. Keep them coming. We will definitely have a realignment questions episode coming in the near future. We definitely know we're behind, so we're excited to do that. So before we jump into the Joe Weisenthal episode, huge shout out to Lincoln Network, the Reboot Conference. We're continuing to post. I'm super pumped to do something with Sagar and Rachel Bovard the first day of November 6th. They'll be sure to check out rebootconference.org. Now, let's go into the episode.
Joe Weisenthal, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I mean, I feel like I read your stuff literally every single day. So obviously that means we need to have you on here. And Joe, I think we want to start out a little bit big picture before we get into the stimulus negotiations, your kind of view of the economy, which is that our podcast is predicated on the idea that there is a realignment in politics, in business, and in media. How do you see this as somebody who's kind of covered these macro political economic trends? I mean, media as well. You've covered the New York Times yeah. and other places. How do you see this phenomenon as just somebody who's been an observer for quite some time?
I mean, it's a great question. I think, you know, I tend to write a lot about economics, and I think we're sort of in a period in which a lot of sort of things that people just accepted as absolutely true that were then the jumping off point for further debate are being fundamentally questioned. And so like a big one now in the context of stimulus and everything else going on in the economy, and I write about it all the time, is like the deficit and fiscal sustainability. And there were like certain baseline assumptions about the deficit, government spending, and so forth that weren't particularly contested. And then that's where the debate happened. So it's like some sort of shared notions of like, okay, balanced budgets are a per se good thing. That was just, you know, it sort of went unquestioned. Yeah. And, you know, like one of the things that I see is like, okay, obviously this year and for a while now, people have become questioning that. But it's not just that. I just think that's like a good example of certain things. And I don't even think it's like a left or right issue per se. It's not a Democratic yeah. or Republican issue per se. Certain assumptions about the benefits of trade, certain assumptions about how monetary policy worked, they're just completely uncontested. And you see it on the big picture level, and you also see it like narrow things. I mean, even like say the Federal Reserve sort of itself rethinking some of its assumptions about models that were used to anticipate when inflation could happen or how tight the labor market could get or the benefits of a tight labor market, there is just a lot of rethinking. And, you know, like I've had this thought after the 2009, after the great financial crisis, like crises opened the door to rethinking things because mm-hmm. suddenly certain ideas automatically become discredited. And then people are like, well, what are the new things? And I feel like that's definitely happening again now.
Man, yeah. There's so much there. Here's what I'll sort of start. Let's put some meat on the bones of your point about we're rethinking things. So you're talking about balanced budgets and deficits that relates to sort of austerity policy. How did that received wisdom operationalize itself as from 2009 onwards, right? So like, it, you know, 2009, it's the financial crisis has just sort of ended. It's the Obama administration. How did the received wisdom around those questions guide the course over the next 8 years?
Well, you know, like, look, there have always been people who in when a crisis hit or when a downturn hit advocated for more spending, anti-austerity. Mm-hmm. That's not itself particularly new, of course. And people have said, okay, I mean, we had the Recovery Act in 2009, and we had, you know, like we had Bush twice sending out literally helicopter money twice during his administration. I mean, people think there's like some radical idea to like just give people money. Bush did it twice. It wasn't even that controversial, cutting people a check. So we've always had this idea of, you know, counter-cyclical fiscal policy as a tool to be used in a downturn. But what I think was not particularly questioned was that these activities were kind of seen as what I would say a necessary evil. And so it's like, okay, look, we're in a downturn, so we really do need to spend more money. It's unfortunate that we have to do it, but we have to do it. And then, you know, we can't use this very much. It is sort of like an unfortunate thing that we have to do. And I think what's actually being contested or debated is not so much the notion of that we should spend money or resist austerity in a downturn, but that this is a necessary evil as opposed to not evil at all, just sort of basic macro management, and B, that it's not something we need to immediately pull back on as soon as we can. That is, you know, it's like, okay, we're out of the worst of the crisis. Let's get to fiscal consolidation or austerity. That there is not something per se good about balanced budgets, you know, that the Clinton surpluses didn't really get us anything good necessarily. And so that is the part that some of these, there's not something inherently unsustainable or something inherently bad. To me, that's the part that's getting rethought in mm-hmm. a sort of very, with interesting implications.
Well, Joe, I mean, it's not a secret to you. This is heresy to a lot of people who listen to our podcast, to a lot of people who work in professional Washington politics. So let's actually, like Marshall said, what is the deal with debt? We now have a lot of debt, according to a lot of people. We've spent trillions and trillions of dollars. We have this stuff on the Fed balance sheet. I mean, are our grandkids screwed, like people say? Just what does that mean? What actually should we think about debt? What has been changed about that in this crisis and going forward?
So I say two things. I always love like the grandkids question because you always hear it and it's like, oh, you know, like we don't want to, we want to leave a good future to our grandkids, which is true, right? I mean, that's not a wrong thing. Like we sort of don't want to ruin the world. But on the other hand, like, you know, our grandkids or our kids are in school right now and their parents theoretically are working.
Right.
And you're not exactly doing the grandkids or the kids any favor if their parents go on unemployment or are straight up unemployed or don't have income. Like that's not exactly, you know, you think about the kids, like unemployment of their parents is not a good thing. Cutting back basic public services, whether education, health spending, is not exactly a good way to like foster the youth of the future. So even on its own terms, setting aside debt at all, even on its own terms, the idea never made any, it really doesn't make any sense. It sort of falls apart on its own terms. Now, this idea that, okay, that if we have a lot of debt, that's somehow like the bill comes due one day, which to me fails both empirically and theoretically because A, we've been, you know, I've heard this my whole life. I'm 40 now. I remember like watching, I have this like distinct memory of like watching some sitcom as a kid and the main character's friend was on the phone, and the parents made a joke about, oh, your phone bill's going to run up the national debt or equal the national debt. Yeah. It's like the first time. That was like, I was like six or like maybe eight.
Yeah, right.
And so this idea that it was like going to come due, it's like always like right around the corner. And A, it doesn't happen. And B, unfortunately, it's one of these assertions that's sort of unfalsifiable. Like, I can't prove that there isn't going to be some disaster about X tomorrow, but that doesn't necessarily make it a compelling argument. But then the real sort of like theoretical sort of rethink is just whether sort of a government debt in its own currency is really debt as we conceive of it, as you and I know it, because you have people have credit card debt and household debt and mortgages and student loans. And, you know, again, the sort of the question is, you know, I can't print dollars. I can't create dollars, but the U.S. government can. So dollars created in the government's own currency are fundamentally different. The best analogy is kind of like, you know, an airline can run out of seats, but it can't run out of frequent flyer miles. And so the idea of thinking, oh, this is a problem, is kind of like thinking like, oh, this Delta or some airline is going to run out of frequent flyer miles. And again, people sort of get this and they'll be like, well, yeah, okay, yes, we know trivially it's true that the government can't run out of its own currency, can never be forced to default. But where I think, you know, if you say that to someone, like, okay, yeah, that's probably true. Right. But where I think this sort of like big thing is that the implications of that are far more profound than people realize, because because once you sort of establish that no amount of sort of no nominal amount of debt can force you to default, it also questions of like, okay, well, what is exactly the problem? And then people sort of say, oh, inflation, but that never really seems to materialize either. The dollar is going to collapse, so it's like we become Venezuela or Zimbabwe, but that doesn't seem to happen either. Because once you establish that there is no credit constraint on federal government spending, all these other bad things that are supposed to happen, they kind of fall apart under reasoning too. And essentially what you see is these become more accounting actions than they really are, if, you know, you or I took on debt.
Right.
I think considering the nature of our audience, we'd be remiss without discussing other sort of expansive ideas that, like you said, with Bush and the helicopter money aren't necessarily new, but for people's frameworks are new. What do you think about the debates over universal basic income, especially as a result of what's sort of gone on the last 6 or 7 months?
I mean, the last 6 or 7 months have really just been one of the most extraordinary sort of proofs of concept of what the U.S. government or what a government can do. And I think, look, we want to like back up to what the sort of like core economic problem is and sort of a core insight, which is that everybody's spending is someone else's income or vice versa. Everybody's income is someone else's spending. And there's just, you know, that's an accounting fact, but it's a useful thing to keep in mind. And so if everybody tries to save at once, and this, you know, this is basic Keynes, but the implication is sort of, it's still underappreciated after all this time, which is that if everybody tries to save at once or spends less at once, everybody gets poorer. And so we knew that there was this big health shock, and that was going to cause a major retrenchment in spending, particularly in-person services, because for at least some period of time, that's dangerous. And if we didn't do something to replace that lost income in some way, that meant millions of workers losing income. That meant businesses that couldn't pay rent. And so you just see, like, you know, there is no way to avoid the idea that if people are going to stop spending in dramatic fashion in some period of time, there's an extraordinary amount of lost income for a bunch of other people, which means more cutting back on spending. Other people lose income, and then you have a depression. And what we saw is that it was not hard, in a sense, to avert a depression. All we had to do was write, pass a law that replaced trillions of dollars in lost income. And like we did it instantly, far faster than people ever anticipated. So I don't know, like, you know, going forward, whether universal basic income is necessarily the sort of the policy response of the future per se. but the sort of premise behind it that just giving people income is extraordinarily powerful and effective has really been borne out.
Yes. And
quick follow-up on that, which is, and this was the intense debate, we sort of see this afterwards, about the government giving money to businesses instead of giving money directly to people. So there's a lot of debates about that sort of, what do we think about that part of it? Because I guess the thing that's interesting to me is that a lot of people make the argument that we just supported like the rich and the wealthy, but it sort of is premised on this idea that the government can't really do things. I'm just like, what do you think about that?
Yeah. You know, I'll say two things. I mean, I do think there is this aspect of this crisis that has been a sort of extraordinary upward redistribution of wealth, but not really so much of because of our like fiscal or monetary policies per se. I mean, a big part of it is essentially that a bunch of small service businesses closed down, and what was open was Amazon and Walmart and a few giant businesses.
Right.
And there were a few absolutely enormous businesses that were in an amazing position to take advantage of the fact that everyone was just home on their computers all day, or if they could. So there has been this sort of redistribution effect whereby, very large companies have just been extraordinarily experienced this huge windfall from this crisis. But I don't really think it's due to the sort of fiscal, the CARES Act, the Fed, or anything like that per se. And, you know, look, I think that in terms of our approach, it was a multi-pronged approach. I mean, think about the Federal Reserve. It's sort of, the main thing it did was sort of backstop credit markets so that there wouldn't be this like huge run on the system. And that's what we saw in the middle of March, which is just that every business sort of, almost no matter how healthy, saw its borrowing rates shoot up. So there was sort of a run on the corporate sector. And so you can think of the Fed as having chopped off the sort of left tail of outcomes. And then on the fiscal side, PPP program, there will probably be some debate about how effective it was in the end, but it got a lot of money to small businesses. And then we did something that we'd never done before, which is that we, millions of people essentially had their salary paid for almost in full by the federal government for a period of about 4 months, I think it was, via the sort of expanded unemployment insurance. And so essentially you can think of all these private businesses as having sort of temporarily put their payrolls on the public tab. Right. And that was pretty effective. Now, part of the problem is that we let the program lapse, and it's been months now since it's gone, and the virus is still here. So you have all these like businesses that are still impaired because without the virus having gone away, activity is still at a depressed level for many areas, and we let the program lapse. But the fundamental premise of sort of moving payrolls to the public sector for some temporary basis while we control the virus does not strike me as unsound. And for a while, again, it sort of worked a lot better than I think most people would have guessed back in the worst periods of March or April.
Right. Right before we get to the impact of the stimulus negotiations, which are literally ongoing as you and I are talking, so it's kind of funny, I want to get to this idea about tax cuts and stimulus. What did we learn about that? Which is, did we learn which is more effective based on the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act versus the cash infusions through unemployment and the stimulus checks this time around? Is it even fair to compare the two? What do we think?
I mean, I think it's absolutely fair. I mean, you know, unfortunately, I think if you look at the impact of the 2017 tax cuts, it's pretty hard to see much of a beneficial impact. I mean, especially, you know, like one of the problems that has sort of plagued the U.S. economy for quite some time, for at least the last decade, maybe even longer, arguably, is that just that sort of corporate investment has not been particularly high. And so there's this idea that, if we get our tax rates in line to some, you know, closer national standard, or simplify the tax code, or just cut taxes, then that will cause more investment. And I think there was like a little bit of corporate investment bump right afterwards due to some of the accounting changes. So you could like immediately expense investments, but that's like kind of a one-off thing. And I think like, The The reason investment has been mild, or a compelling story for why business investment in the U.S. has been mild, is that demand and consumer strength has been mild. And so if you think about a business, do you go out, do you build a new factory? Do you go out and hire workers? Do you upgrade a software system? Do you install a new robotics thing because your tax rates are lower, or because there's some booming demand for your good, for what you sell, that you just have to invest to meet the demand for it? And so I think there's a pretty compelling case that ultimately the reasons why business is invest is because demand for their goods is strong. And so if you sell some widget or something and people are buying it like crazy, you're gonna like build new factories, and you might invest in some sort of technology, robots, software, computers, whatever, to be able to deliver that more efficiently. And so the demand essentially creates the demand for investment. And so when you compare tax cuts to stimulus, I think what we saw is giving people money who are inclined to spend it. And the people who are inclined to spend it are people who aren't already, you know, super rich and just sort of like middle class and below people. If you give them money, it's highly likely that they'll spend it. And that creates extraordinary surge in overall consumption. And then businesses hire and invest to meet that. And so I do think that, like, we identify a sort of core issue or one of the structural flaws of the economy right now. The key to addressing underinvestment is to do something about demand. And the way to do something about demand is, again, just give people more money or somehow increase their purchasing power.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize how critical this is. And this is probably the most important thing that I've learned from you and reading your work just over the last couple of years, which is that this idea about demand and business investment, because that is how we drive the policy discussion here in Washington. And that kind of brings me to the stimulus negotiations, Joe. You've written a lot in your newsletter about the stakes of where we are. In a bit, I'm going to ask you to give me the doomer case for the economy, like we're screwed no matter what, or actually we're going to be okay. What are the stakes actually of this stimulus package? $1.8 trillion on the table, largely being ignored or pushed aside by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, not letting the Republicans off the hook. Many of them don't even want to vote for such a thing. But what are the real stakes as you see it in economic terms for American citizens?
Sure. I mean, we still have millions of people who are unemployed. And not only that, and the number of people whose layoffs are characterized as permanent has been rising throughout this whole time. And so we had unemployment, I think it peaked almost around 20%. Fortunately, most of those, or a lot of those, were in fact sort of temporary layoffs, like true furloughs, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was because of some restaurant or something else temporarily shutting down, with the intention of rehiring the people when the virus passed. There has been reopenings. Millions of people have started working again. The unemployment rate is back below 8%. Objectively good. That is good news. It's better than a lot of people expected. The Federal Reserve back in the spring thought we'd be fortunate if the unemployment rate fell below 10% by the end of the year. Exceeded expectations. Unfortunately, the number of people who say their unemployment or their layoff is it permanent, meaning they don't expect to be called back for their job, has grown steadily and is still, as of last month, grown at a faster pace than in the run-up to the great financial crisis. So we're still on a worse trajectory than that. So just right off the bat, there are millions of people who don't have jobs, and that's millions of people who are struggling. And so just from a sort of pure pure basic household consumption, restarting some sort of unemployment insurance expansion, I think there's a very strong case for that. Then you have other things. So obviously, in many places, the tax base has been totally obliterated, declining activity, declining sales tax, loss of income from tourism and so forth. And so then you sort of talk about this like follow-on pain, which is, okay, after the hit, then you have cities and states, and of course this has already happened and it could happen more, further layoffs or reductions. And this was like a major drag on the economy in the wake of the great financial crisis. I mean, it took years for city and state employment to get back to 2008 levels after the great financial crisis. I mean, there's just it was a totally unnecessary drag. I mean, just like fundamentally, there was a virus, right? We have this virus. It's awful. Now, one can debate its severity, et cetera, but why does the existence or the emergence of a virus mean that for years afterwards, people have to suffer degraded public services? Just intuitively, that makes no sense, right? Why? It's not there's no mathematical law. There's nothing that says because this thing came and a lot of people got sick, okay, you have to suffer through reduction in public transportation spending. Why? There's no basis for that. It's just like what happens. However, if there is not sort of something done to replace that lost income, because again, by and large, cities and states don't really borrow much or have much capacity to borrow. And so then you have these cuts. And then finally, you have a lot of businesses whose business models may be totally sound, but in the current environment, maybe just barely hanging on. And so, you know, that again, restaurants, like I guess most places by now have like reopened, but obviously there's a lot of diminished activity because people don't want to, until the virus is totally gone, people are going to change or are going to change their behaviors. We always, every day, are like reading about bars and music clubs and other things like that are totally sound businesses. And so then you have this issue of, okay, you could have this situation in which you let all so many entities fail for no compelling reason. Then one day, hopefully, we have a vaccine, but there's nowhere to necessarily go back to work to. And so even in the best of cases, then, in addition to having all the people who are without jobs on a permanent basis because their employer just didn't make it through this crisis, we're in a position of degraded supply side capacity. We want, when the vaccine comes or when the virus just is not much of an issue anymore, we want to be able to produce either goods or services at the same level that we did before. Businesses are really hard to reconstitute. I mean, you could have a restaurant go out of business and then that space is theoretically available for another restaurant to open up. But it's hard. I mean, like most things fail. You can, it's very easy for a business to go out of business. It's not easy for something new to start. It's risky.
Yep.
It takes time. What worked one time may not work again in the same space. So letting the supply side of the economy degrade, and here's where I think, you know, there was a lot of soundness to the PPP program of keeping production capacity online so that it could reemerge. That's an important part of the long-term recovery.
Yeah, and thanks for talking about that, just because Sagar and I actually get in a lot of fights with people about this whole like propping up zombie companies and industries that were going to sort of die, because you have to delineate, and let's delineate right here, right now, right? So for example, Disney just announced that it's reorganizing its entire structure away from theaters and towards streaming. Disney Plus subscribers, shout out, they're not paying us, but you know, I'm a huge user, but that's a clear case of there was this long-term trend of the internet, which we could separate movie theaters. But when it comes to office buildings, so are you recording this, and are you in New York right now?
I am, and I'm in an office building right now.
That's insane.
There aren't many people here then.
We have to ask you, like, what is your thought on the whole like cities debate? You know, New York, San Francisco, like what do you sort of think?
Well, let me just, before I have thoughts, but before, I just want to say something about the zombies thing that you brought up, because I think it's really important. Because one of the things you hear during any sort of like discussion of like bailouts or stimulus is like, capitalism is about, you know, there are winners and losers. Capitalism without bankruptcy is like religion without hell or something like that. It's a common cliche. That is true. Like, that's not wrong. But that is, you know, winners and losers. So it's like if Netflix rises and movie theaters over time become less important, that is fine. I mean, that is what it is. That is, you know, there's competition, new technologies. That is fundamentally a different thing than a mass cessation of activity in which a bunch of businesses, there's nothing like sort of like moral or right or.
There's no moral hazard.
Yeah, there's no moral hazard. It's like, oh, you didn't save for a once in a century pandemic, your business was flawed. I mean, like, it's a fundamentally different thing. Now, if in normal times, sort of Netflix became the dominant way, or people wanted to mostly consume movies at home. And yeah, I think you could make a really good argument that there shouldn't be like a movie theater bailout.
There was no Blockbuster bailout. That's the key thing.
There's no Blockbuster bailout. Right. And that's right. Like there shouldn't have been. There wasn't. There shouldn't have been. That is, when people have that in mind about like capitalism without failure or whatever, like we have that. There were bankruptcies last year. Yes. Like, tons of companies went bankrupt in 2019. Stocks go up, stocks go down. I mean, that's fine. That's good. That's like how it's supposed to work. Mass bankruptcy for a temporary thing does not fit into that framework.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I want to hit cities.
I'm glad you asked that. You know, I think like the cities question is super interesting. And I think there's sort of two things that, you know, like thinking about New York, you know, there's a few things, but like since the internet became a thing, it was like a, you know, sort of like phenomenon, people have been declaring the death of cities for like forever. It's like, distance is dead. And people are just going to like go out and live in the middle of like Nebraska, and they're going to be able to, and you know, real estate prices are going to come down. And I think people should like, before declaring anything, at least think about like why not only did that not happen, it actually, the reverse has happened. It like the last 20 years, the last 10 years have been like this incredible acceleration of the power centers of major cities in this country. And the main, sort of one of the main geographical crises has been, you constantly hear like this sort of like death of small towns. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like there's a compelling argument to be made that the internet has increased the returns of cities. I mean, you know, you think of something like, you know, like Seamless and online ordering. That's great. Right. You know, like I go home and I can order from a million different kinds of restaurants very easily. It's much easier than it used to be. Whereas if I were in a small town, maybe that wouldn't have been so useful. You know, Uber and other sort of interesting transportation things have made getting around cities much easier. Like I used to live in a small town in Vermont. I don't think the various things, the internet, like would have made that life as different as it's changed city life. So I think there are compelling reasons to be bullish on cities. That being said, like, it is conceivable, especially New York, which I think probably does have reason to worry. It is totally conceivable that you get into this very negative spiral where it starts running low on money, cuts essential services, and people understandably like, well, I don't want to live here, where the sort of quality of services continues to get degraded. And you can have a spiral. So I do think there are reasons to be concerned, but this idea that we're all going to like work from home and it doesn't really matter where we are, it's just like, it doesn't seem to fit with any behavior that we've seen since all this. I mean, this technology has been around forever.
And speaking of sort of the last zombie industry that's sort of close to home, like we have to talk media for a second.
Yeah.
So obviously in you're at Bloomberg, so like on a variety of levels, a successful set of publications, but like the broader media industry has been wrecked during this, you know, with the advertising crash. There was already sort of a lot of sort of issues there longer term. Like what are just your expansive thoughts on media?
You know, it's funny. Like, so I started off just like pure blogging. Like in 2005 or 2006.
OG.
Yeah, I had a blog. I think my friend and I started, it was 15 years ago. It was called thestalwart.com, which was how I like got
that's my, the Twitter handle. There we go. Twitter. I was wondering.
And so that was just like, you know, and when I joined Twitter and I used that name, it was because I didn't realize Twitter was going to be this big professional thing. I was going with my name, but I was like, oh, just, you know, this is the name of our blog. And at that time, there was this real sort of, I would say a pirate ship mentality where it's like mainstream media is dead, right? And we're just gonna feast on their carcasses and it's all going all blog. And I can't, like the MSM was done. And that was like super sort of rebellious. And it didn't happen. I mean, it's been a time.
Where are you working now, Joe? That's the real question.
Bloomberg. Yeah, I don't know.
Wait, can we play this game real quick? I've noticed almost every major blogger from 2004 to 2006 is now at a mainstream publication.
Right, we all got absorbed.
Yeah.
We all got absorbed. Yeah. But look, like all the publications that like we thought were just total roadkill, they're thriving. New York Times thriving, Washington Post thriving, all the big cable networks thriving. None of the sort of forecasts of the doom. Now, where you see what's gotten really clobbered, of course, is sort of the middle level publications. Regional newspapers have had a really hard time for sort of obvious reasons, I think in large part because they now compete with each other through the internet in ways they hadn't. But the sort of the forecast of the demise of the MSM, which I totally bought into then, like, it just didn't happen. And it doesn't seem like it's happening. People still watch tons of cable news.
Yeah.
The major newspapers and mostly seem to figure out models. There's interesting stuff going on, but it was not the sort of disaster. This has been a tough period, obviously, due to the advertising crash. On the other hand, like, it finally seems like people pay for media in a way that they didn't. Alternative media is finding new ways to be monetized. So it's hard to make forecasts, but some of the old forecasts definitely hold up pretty bad.
Yeah, I kind of look at it as a two-track thing, where MSM is actually doing better than ever, the traditional ones. And then there's also all this room underneath where, like, the chaff all died, and now everyone's just waiting to see what that looks like.
In 2008 or, no, it must have been, you know, it must have been 2009 or 2000. I think it was 2009. Like, I was a Business Insider at the time, and someone, like, reached out from the New York Times about, like, hey, do you want, like, chat? And my thought was like, why would I want to do that? Like, step aboard the Titanic. I was totally wrong. Like, I was just like, no, I was
that
like,
that was the Titanic back then, right? Like, Carlos Slim had just saved them.
Right. It did. But it really felt like, why would I, you know, I want some job security. But now it's like the exact opposite. I was just completely wrong in terms of how
things. Yeah. I think their stock price is, like, better than ever, actually. I learned that, you know, from you. So this is one thing I want to get with you, which people ask us all the time. They're like, are we screwed? Or are actually everything is going to be okay? And I know you literally wrote about this today, the day that we're taping. If you were going to make the case that, you know, we're doomed, what would you point to? If you'd make the case that we're going to be okay, what would you point to?
You know, the doomed case really would sort of be a combination of a sort of ongoing acceleration of long-term cuts. So a wave of austerity at the state and local level, a wave of small business failures, failing to get aid, combined with an inability of political leaders to do anything about it. Because look, if we could pass another CARES Act, then you just paper over it again, totally effective, spend the money, replace the lost income. Eventually the virus will go away. I'm, you know, hopeful, optimistic about a vaccine. But if you like sort of assume the worst about DC, which is not a horrible assumption these days, but if you sort of assume the worst,
right now you should assume that.
If you assume there's just like complete policy failure, policy gridlock, etc., combined with a sort of protracted defeat of the virus, also not a horrible assumption, and a sort of downward spiral. It doesn't really feel like, I don't feel very strongly that the doom scenario is likely under sort of any scenario. You know, I think it'd have to be a pretty bad situation. But look, there are arguments that things are still on a weakening trend. Again, I mentioned long-term unemployment. This morning I wrote about the sort of inflation data, which you see the sort of contours of an ongoing slump continuing. Big categories like services are consistent with a persistent downturn that has yet to fully arrest itself and reverse. So I don't know whether that looks like doom. It could just look like a very slow recovery. And, you know, the recovery after the great financial crisis was very slow. And I think it's, like, in retrospect, pretty damaging to the country. It's damaging politically. It's damaging to cohesiveness and all kinds of other maladies that happen at the same time. I haven't like done the work, but you think about addiction and sort of other bad things that happen. You know, I think like one of the, this is sort of going to sound weird, but I think like weirdly, one of the sort of emergent ideas in economics that's interesting is like good things are good. And I, that sounds like kind of like tautological, but we really saw in the sort of tail end of the last expansion, sort of 2018, 2019, good things happen when the labor market is tight. We saw wages start to accelerate. We see disadvantaged minority groups, other people who historically have been shut out of the labor market brought in. We see former prisoners, former felons having brought into the workforce. That's what happens the longer an expansion goes on. And those are permanent positives. They're not just temporary positives. A former felon gaining work experience for the first time or for the first time in a long time or having brought into the labor, brought into the labor market after having been shut out, that is worth something that then persists. And then that person has work experience and then they can get another job. So good things are worth striving for. And then the converse is like bad things are bad. It's not just a temporary loss of income or loss of employment. Bad things beget bad things. People get permanent loss of income and earnings power throughout the rest of their life after they lose a job. And so another very slow slog recovery where we're like back at pre-crisis employment levels in the year 2026 would be a real blow, I think, and a real completely sort of unnecessary, unforced harm.
The main thing I'm sort of interested in is the generational aspect here, right? So Sagar and I are what, like late stage millennials. We were sort of economically and politically cognizant during the 2008 financial crisis. So our cohort has gone through two of these things.
Yeah.
Gen Zers are like either entering or going through college. Now, like, what is that going to look like as we sort of look like 10 years out?
I mean, it probably does have a lot to do with the pace of the recovery, but I think there's pretty good evidence that graduating in the wrong year or graduating into a downturn can lead to earnings impairment that lasts for an extremely long time. And so I think there is, we should see that we're in a rush is how I should think about it, that we could go there the slow way or the long way. And that if we don't really do anything on the policy front, if we don't have some big stimulus, we'll probably get back to something resembling full employment eventually. We're probably not going to have a double dip recession or actual like negative GDP growth again for a while. But there are big costs to waiting and big long-term costs. And the sort of degradation of skills, degradation of public services, degradation of investment. I mean, you know, one of the sort of interesting facts, again, I mentioned poor investment, productivity growth in the United States has been really mediocre for a long time. And I think that stems from poor investment growth. So, you know, it's just intuitive. If a company is going to spend on new equipment and new technology, that's how you get higher productivity. There's no incentive to do that spending unless there is demand. And so I think that there's all kinds of negative ramifications, wealth, productivity, standard of living, other things from letting this recovery go longer than it needs to.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I know we got to get you out of here. So there's two things I still want to hit. Number one is an idea that you had voiced to me a couple of months ago, and I think is very profound, which is that there's a thinking in the realm of economics, and I'm probably guilty of this too, of being like, wow, like we shattered all of these norms around spending, which means that from here on out, we're good. Like, we're just going to, the fight will not be over spending. It'll be a fight over who gets what. But if you look at the policy, discussion in DC, that's just not true. And we could be living with this for a long time. Could you just talk about that?
Yeah. Look, I think this is sort of an interesting area that needs to be explored. But like, spending is political and it's sort of unavoidably political. And you could make an argument that to some extent, elected leaders, their job is to get more money for their voters and to deprive money of other voters. And I think this is always going to be the case. So merely demonstrating policy flexibility or shattering these sort of preconceptions is only half the battle. And arguably that's like where the real discussion can begin. So I think like what we see in sort of like the rethinking of the deficit, you know, people have this idea It's so funny. People have this idea that like politicians love to spend like drunken sailors and shower voters with goodies. You always hear that story. It's like, oh, they're going to give all the goodies away before the election. Like, where are they? Like where's all, you know, like they actually, it turns out that's not really the case. Where's all the gleaming new libraries and playgrounds and schools and free universities? Like if politicians actually had that mentality of like, we could just spend unlimited, and like, they don't though. They don't do it. And so people have this idea that that's all politicians do, and they're just going to spend on goodies to get us reelected. And yet by and large, like, we don't, where is it? Where's our like high-speed trains to nowhere and the bridges? Like, we would at least, if politicians were like so reckless, we'd at least have some high-speed train that went nowhere. I don't think there are any.
Where's my Obama phone? That's my main
point. Where's all the wasteful spending? I want to, you know, where is it? It doesn't really think so. Like, the ending of this sort of like, you know, Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, the elimination of the deficit myth doesn't get us all the way there. It just sets the table so that the real discussion can begin. But then you still have the same sort of, you still have the resource fights or the class interest fights or the regional fights or whatever there are. But at least that the people who do believe in public investment aren't arguing with one hand tied behind their back, where they have to somehow contort their view into some box where the, you know, the debt is like very a household critical. Debt.
Yeah.
Sorry, you don't have your last question.
Oh, and I thought you were going to ask it. This is the one that both.
He's Sagar's been excited to ask this. I've been excited to get this.
This is going to piss some people off. What have we learned about Bitcoin, Joe? So there was a lot of myths around Bitcoin. A lot of our listeners are Bitcoiners. I have some Bitcoin. I like Bitcoin. I'm very enthusiastic about it. But I was told that in the middle of a depression, while the Federal Reserve's got all this money on its balance sheet, that my Bitcoin should be worth a lot more than it is right now, and it's just not. And also, there was this halving thing, and that didn't work out either. So what's going on here, Joe?
So I've been really, you know, I have never been this a believer in the idea that, like, if we, like, you know, Fed expands its balance sheet or deficit suddenly, that's going to be, like, good for Bitcoin. Like, I think it's based on sort of unsound economics. But even I've been surprised by the degree this year to which like Bitcoin has just been behaved like a normal correlated asset. Like you charted against you know, the NASDAQ, it crashed in March, it rallied, but not, you know, it's had a good year, but you know, like pick any like cloud computing stock and it's almost certainly done way better than Bitcoin this year. So I think it's like actually a little bit worrisome for Bitcoin that sort of so early in its evolution. And I think the total value of all Bitcoin is like $200 billion, which if it were a company is kind of like, you know, a sort of reasonably sized enterprise software company. It's already behaving like a highly correlated risk asset. Mm-hmm. It's kind of worrisome. Like it's already like, it's barely been integrated into the financial system yet. Very few institutions actually have it. And yet it's just basically acting like a thing you sell when the S&P is down and a thing you buy when the S&P is up. It's kind of worrisome. And then, you know, the whole like decline of the halving, that never made any sense. It totally debunked that.
Well, my favorite thing, I'll let you go after this, was that video of the Winklevi with Dave Portnoy, where they were trying to explain to him the virtues of Bitcoin. And they were like, well, Elon Musk could like mine gold from an asteroid, and that's why Bitcoin is theoretically better. And I think you were like, that there are plenty of good arguments for Bitcoin, but like that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard.
You know, I gotta say, like, those videos are genius because like I don't usually watch them that often, the other Portnoy videos. But every time I do, like if I just like tweet out like X happened, there's always something amazing. Like that is content gold. That, you know, it's amazing. Like that time, there was another time, like he was like picking stocks with Scrabble letters.
Yeah.
Amazing. Just amazing content. But I was very entertained by the asteroid theory that Elon was going to launch an asteroid mining operation. We'd got unlimited gold from outer space. That would crash the price of gold. And so you got to be in Bitcoin. It's just absolutely amazing stuff.
We'll end where we began. That will be very good for our grandchildren when they have
all the gold.
All
the gold that they ever need.
They can go buy our gold.
Joe, thank you so much for coming. This is really great.
Thank you, Joe. We really appreciate it.
That was really fun. Soon. All right. Catch you later.
See you guys.
Bye, y'all.
Hope you guys enjoy the episode. Just as a reminder, you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and ask us a question in a written review, and we will answer it right here on the air. If not, no worries. You can just take a screenshot of a 5-star review and send it in to realignmentpod@gmail.com. We'll answer your question there too. So either way, it's a lot of fun, and keep those questions coming, guys. We love it.
And as always, huge shout out to Lincoln Network for hosting and supporting this podcast. We will see you next week.